What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. That's right. Those of you who are not Catholic, that's who we're specifically talking to, primarily, that is. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, maybe you don't know any priests, maybe you don't know any Catholics, well enough, or maybe those who you do know who are Catholic, maybe they wouldn't know how to answer the question. We are here for you. We are here to give you what the Catholic Church actually teaches about that subject. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're listening to us outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response. It'll be a quick robo-type response. And then once you get that, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email if you prefer that, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Aquiles, our producer. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. Rich Jesse handles social media for us. If you are watching us right now on YouTube, well, you can put that question of yours in the comments box. Rich will see that. He'll shoot it to us here in the studio, and we would love to answer your question on today's program, no matter how you get it to us. Here's that number again, 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Very well. Are you ready for Thanksgiving? We're only a couple days away.
Well, I'm getting there, pretty much so, almost.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm going to lead off here with an email from Mark. Is there an interpretation of what was Jesus writing on the ground in that Bible passage about the women caught in adultery?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's speculation. And, some writers have speculated that maybe he was writing the sins of the people standing around when he said, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. But, of course, we don't know. Text doesn't say.
Yeah, doesn't say. There you go, Mark. Thanks so much for your email. Here's one from Theo. Did God stop being present in the Holy of Holies after the veil was torn? And why did the disciples continue to go to the temple, to the synagogue? Can you talk about this transition? Thanks, Theo.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So let's distinguish a couple modes of presence. All right. So Catholic doctrine teaches that the divinity is ubiquitous. And immense is the word I was using.
Okay.
Immensity. And immensity is a thicker concept than ubiquity or omnipresence. You could have a gas extended throughout space and cover every inch of a room. It's everywhere in the room.
Yeah.
That's omnipresent. All right. But immensity is something even thicker than that. It means that all of God's being is present entirely to every particle of creation. Whereas, a gas becomes more diffuse as it diffuses through space. Mm-hmm. God doesn't become more diffuse. There's not more of God in an elephant than in a mouse. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to think of an analogy. So go to a movie theater and imagine a movie projector that's projecting the film up on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And is this a good analogy? No, it's a bad analogy. Forget that analogy.
Forget about that analogy.
All right. So the point is God is everywhere, and he's everywhere in the thickest sense possible. All right, I'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
All right. So he's not absent from the Holy of Holies any more than he's absent from, say, from the stomach of a gnat. He's not absent from the stomach of a gnat. Like, he's making the stomach of the gnat happen in real time, right?
Uh-huh.
He is the reason and the ultimate cause of the existence of the gnat's stomach, as well as the elephant's stomach, as well as, anything else in all reality. Another mode of presence we could talk about, and that is that there were times in ancient Israel's history when he would, he would manifest what we call a theophany, some visible sign of his presence. that is not in itself God. Like, you know, God is not a burning bush. And yet he causes the manifestation of the burning bush to signal his presence to Moses. So Moses recognizes that something big is about to happen. So that kind of presence, yeah. So if you went into the temple after the rending of the curtain, you're not going to, you know, the fluorescent light bulbs have gone off, so to speak. Okay. What does it have to do with the apostles continuing to worship in synagogues? Well, nothing really. The apostles did continue to worship in synagogues, and you know, until about the second, you know, third, fourth generation, Christianity was understood by most of its contemporaries to be a sect of Judaism. Judaism was full of sects. It was full of diverse interpretations and points of view. What many had in common was the belief that there would be a coming kingdom of God when God would vindicate the righteous and punish the wicked and restore Israel's former glory, and sometimes in a very geopolitical way. And the disciples themselves seem to have thought this. You remember when Christ ascended, before he ascends into heaven, they say, "Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" They're still thinking in those terms, right? Now I've lost the thread of the question. What was I answering?
You were answering about...
The temple yes, of glory. Yeah, I got off into the kingdom and I forgot what I was talking about.
All right.
Sorry, I'm sleepy today.
That's okay.
They're still thinking in those terms. And they think that, you know, they're thinking in terms of you know, Jesus is a Jewish Messiah who's going to redeem Israel. And they knew that as part of that expectation, Gentiles would come to worship the God of Israel. And so the Gentile mission seems to begin with the idea that how are we going to incorporate some Gentiles into this Jewish thing we have going on?
Mm-hmm.
And there doesn't seem to have been a real expectation that it would ultimately become a Gentile church. And Paul himself seems to be taken a little bit by surprise at that fact. When he writes the book of Romans, which is toward the end of his career, he recognizes that, like, okay, this thing is becoming quite pervasive, that we have this pretty significant Gentile element, and the Jews themselves are not hopping on board. And then, of course, that becomes the story of Christianity, right?
Yeah.
It becomes a Gentile church. But at least in terms of their own lifetime, you know, the apostles, you know, continued to operate within the world of Judaism. They preached in synagogues. That's where most of their converts came. They didn't separate themselves from the Commonwealth of Israel to proclaim Jesus as the Messiah.
Theo, thanks so much for your question today. In a moment, we'll get to the phones. We'll begin with Catherine in Des Moines. Lines are open for you as well at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Andrews, 833-288-3986. If you're listening outside North America, dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You know, we have listeners all over the world. We talk about that from time to time. We also talk about the variety of ways you can listen to EWTN, and one of those is the Amazon Echo. It's a smart speaker. It allows you to use just your voice. All you have to do is just say, Alexa, play EWTN Radio. How easy is that? Check out the Amazon Echo today. It's another reason why EWTN is everywhere. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Catherine, a first-time caller from Des Moines, listening on the great Iowa Catholic Radio. Hey, Catherine, what's on your mind today?
Yes, good afternoon, Dr. Anders. So I am a catechist, and one of my teenage students, who's very intelligent, very devoted to her Catholic faith, was recently in a conversation and was challenged to answer two statements. So I'm calling to ask you how to respond to both of these. The first actually contains a couple of statements within it. It was essentially that Christianity is the true religion, Christ died for the Christian church, and every other religion besides Christianity is man-made. And to prove these points, the person asked, where in the Bible does the word Catholic appear? And you see that it never does. And then the second statement was that Christians and Catholics cannot marry because they will be unequally yoked, and Christ said not to be unequally yoked. So thank you so much in advance for your guidance on these.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, of course, I chuckle because the whole thing is predicated on a distinction between Christianity and Catholicism,
yeah,
which as a Catholic I find laughable, right? Because Catholics are followers of Jesus Christ and we worship him as God.
Hello.
And so I think that's kind of a silly distinction. But the I also think that the objection that the word Catholic doesn't occur in Scripture is honestly, I think it's laughably naive. I don't care if the word Catholic occurs in Scripture. First of all, I want to know if the concept occurs in Scripture. I mean, otherwise, it's just a semantic question, right, about what word is used,
yeah,
the meaning of a word. But yeah, the concept is absolutely represented in the Bible. So what do we mean by the concept Catholic? Well, we mean that the community that Christ founded, and that's what we're talking about here, the church. He said to St. Peter, "You're Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." So Christ has the intent to establish a gathered community of peoples, that community, the word Catholic, indicates that it is universal in scope, right? And Christ says this. He says to St. Peter and to the apostles, go into all nations and make disciples. So assimilate them universally into this institution that I have founded, this gathered group of people that I've established.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the universal scope of that mission is what is meant by Catholicism. Now, in the Catholic Church, we actually have a more robust definition either than universality. We talk about one holy Catholic and apostolic. So let's talk a little bit about the unity aspect. So not only does Christ tell the disciples to go into all nations, but they are to teach a determinate body of content, namely everything I have commanded you. And their unanimity in the faith is a criterion of their orthodoxy. And so when you get into Paul's letter to the Corinthians, his first one, he insists in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 10, that Christians agree on everything. He doesn't say some things. He says agree on everything. And that lack of agreement, visible agreement with the church, is grounds for barring individuals from communion. And says that when you come together, as it is 1 Corinthians 10 and following, when you come together to celebrate you're not celebrating the Eucharist. You're actually blaspheming the Eucharist because you are at enmity with your brothers. You're not in unity, and you have to agree on everything. Otherwise, you're not fit to go to communion. So in sacred scripture, you have the foundation of a visible society by Jesus, endowed with particular authority, namely, whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven, giving you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, etc. You have its universal mission to all nations to teach a determinate body of content about which all members of that group are to be in unanimity. Well, this is just what we mean by Catholic.
Yeah.
So you want to toss the word? Toss the word. I don't care. I mean, the word's inconsequential. It's the reality that I'm after. Now, your friend or your student's friend who is alleging that there is this thing called Christianity distinct from that body that Christ founded, I would be willing to bet that whatever that individual means by Christianity, it isn't what I just described. It isn't a singular organization with the power of binding and loosing, with a universal mission to teach a determinate body of content about which all of the participants are in agreement. That certainly doesn't describe the history of Protestantism at all. At all.
Yeah.
Right? Which is characterized by disagreement, not by agreement. And they can't even agree about what to agree about.
Yeah.
Right? There's not a consistent understanding within the Protestant tradition about what constitutes the difference between dogma and opinion or the essential and the non-essential. Even that question is variable in Protestant history. So that's not a description of Protestant history. It is a description of Catholic history, whatever the origin of the word, right? So I guess that's number one. Number two, Catholics and Christians should not. Oh, I also want to say something about. I want to say something about the charge that every religion other than quote Christianity end quote is man-made. That always strikes me as odd. That criticism strikes me as odd for a number of reasons. First of all, again, I'm presuming we're talking about the history of Protestants here in contrast to Catholics, because that's usually who makes this kind of charge. I wonder if this fellow who made this claim has ever bothered to read any Protestant church history. I mean, I've read lots of it. I mean, lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of it. And one thing that's manifestly obvious is if Protestants themselves disagree radically on almost every Christian doctrine, which they do, then clearly some of those things are man-made, right?
Yeah,
you know, I mean, like they're not a matter of divine revelation. But even to the extent that Protestants respond legitimately to revelation, their own internal doctrinal history shows development in response to social forces, economic forces, demographic forces, and intellectual trends. That seems very human to me, right? And so this sort of absolute dichotomistic interpretation that a thing is either divine or human, and that's an absolute mutually exclusive dichotomy, doesn't seem true to, certainly not to Protestant history, but not to Catholic history or to biblical history.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, Jesus didn't hesitate to use human elements in his teaching or ministry. You know, St. Paul quotes Cleanthes the Stoic, the hymn to the sun. No, I'm sorry, the hymn to Zeus, I believe it is, in Acts chapter 19, when he's 17 when he's in Athens? Yeah, 17. When he's on the Areopagus. So sacred scripture includes citations from pagan religious traditions to make gospel points. Like, so this whole, like, it's human, it's divine, like, no. The way to think of it is God superintends human history, and particularly the history of Israel, to bring the human race to a particular point of development, right, so that it can embrace the message of Jesus Messiah and then internally transform itself. It's the, sort of the constant interpenetration of the divine and the human over the course of human history that we celebrate for its advance in justice and charity and fidelity and so forth. And it's, we're not Gnostics that think you have this utterly divine realm here and this utterly human realm down here and never the two shall meet. I mean, the person of Christ himself is a visible illustration of the principle that the divine and the human can be and ought to be hypostatically united in one person, namely that of Jesus, right? And then we participate in him so that we can share in his divinity, right? Now let's go on to this business about, you know, Christians and non-Christians shouldn't marry or they'll be unequally yoked. Well, I'm just going to let pass the Christian-Catholic thing and just say, should Christians marry non-Christians? Well, there's should and there's can.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Catholic Church takes the position that, you know, marriage is a pretty serious business, and you need to be in you know, of one mind about how you're going to raise the kids and conduct yourselves. And so if you marry outside the household of faith, it's going to create headaches for you. I mean, that's the Catholic position. And that's why if Catholics want to marry non-Catholics, they actually have to get a dispensation, you know, from the impediment of disparity of cult, right? They can get that dispensation, but they have to ask for it, right? And sacred scripture deals with this. You know, the Pauline exception, the Pauline privilege is that if a Catholic... if two pagans marry, and then one subsequently becomes Catholic, and the other spouse remains pagan and refuses to live with the Catholic, wants to dissolve the marriage because of that person's Catholicism, because of that person's conversion, Paul says that the Catholic is not bound in such circumstances and may leave the marriage.
Okay.
It's one of the few exceptions to indissolubility.
Uh-huh.
But he also contemplates the possibility that you could have a Catholic married to a non-Catholic. And that you could, and that if they're willing to stay together, you should stay. So you can regularize that situation and make it bearable, although it's not always going to work out. So your friend's criterion is not biblical, right? And it's not consistent with certainly not Catholic teaching, but not even St. Paul's teaching.
Yeah.
So I mean, I would love to. I mean, I'm taking it that this is a kid who made these claims, right? Who is just very naive about the scriptures, about his own ecclesiastical history.
Catherine, is that helpful for you?
Very much.
Appreciate your call so much. And I absolutely have your student friend there give us a call. I'd love to talk with him or her. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Let's go to New Orleans and talk with Matthew, listening on the great Catholic Community Media. Hello, Matthew. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, I have the question, if St. Peter was a married man and Jesus chose him to be the first pope of the church, why now does the church teach that priests cannot be married?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question a lot. So there's a huge difference between married men becoming priests and priests becoming married men. Right? There's a big difference between that.
Yeah.
And so Peter was a married man who became a priest. He was not a priest who became a married man. And so it's always been the case that once you are ordained to the priesthood, you cannot then subsequently acquire a wife. But it has also always been the case that some married men in the Catholic Church are permitted to become priests. That remains the case today. It was the case in antiquity. It's always been the case, and it remains the case. And, you know, I'm a practicing Roman Catholic in Birmingham, Alabama, and we have an ordained and cardinated married Catholic priest in ministry in my diocese.
Sure do.
Right? And you will find, like, not a few dioceses in the Roman Catholic Latin Rite Church in the West where there are married Catholic priests in ministry. That does happen. It's a minority, but it happens. In Eastern Catholicism, it's far more common to have married Catholic priests. But again, the way they got there was they married first and entered the clerical state later. If their wife dies, St. Paul's admonition in the pastoral epistles is that the priest is to be the husband of but one wife, meaning you don't get to pick up a second one if you put the first one aside,
yeah.
Right? You got one and done, right? Now, in terms of there being a strong preference for the celibate priesthood, and this is why the majority of Latin Catholic priests are not married, is because, again, Scripture says that's preferable. Paul writes about this in his first letter to the Corinthians, and he says, it is better to remain unmarried so that a man can give himself entirely to the work of the ministry, and the wife he will have divided loyalties if he's married. And of course, Paul was unmarried, and Jesus, the great high priest and the model of all priesthood, was himself unmarried. And so, you know, we're really trying to be very consistently biblical in our application of these principles.
Appreciate your call, Matthew. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN. Joellen is listening in New Mexico on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hi, Joellen. What's on your mind today? Joellen, hi. Go right ahead.
My question is, in my Bible study, we were talking about when the curtain in the temple was torn, mm-hmm. and then the temple was destroyed in 70, were the Jewish people still having sacrifices in the temple, you know, animal sacrifices in the
Oh, yeah. Yeah, quite a lot, actually. They you know, you heard the expression, you know, all day long and twice on Sundays. That was eminently true of temple sacrifices. And in fact, when the Romans were besieging Jerusalem in 70 AD, the priests were doing overtime duty. They were hoping to appease the wrath of God and have him miraculously turn away the Romans. So they were just sacrificing like nobody's business. Yeah, temple sacrifice continued all the way up till the destruction of the temple.
All right. Appreciate your call, Ellen. Thanks for listening to us in New Mexico on Sirius XM Channel 130. I have a couple of lines open for you right now. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, maybe it's something that has been on your mind for a while, and you've been thinking about it every now and then, and you're thinking, well, maybe today's the day. Well, guess what? Today is the day. Give us a call at 833-288-EWTN if you have a question for Dr. David Anders, or maybe you'd like to explain to us what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. In any event, 833-288-EWTN, or you can text the letters EWTN to 58177. In a moment, we'll talk with Chris in Lubbock. Waiting for your call right now, 833-288-EWTN, for Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Now, I know that we've got lots coming up. We've got Thanksgiving. We've got Black Friday. We've got, for a lot of people, a long weekend. But guess what? If you're listening to us in Kansas, your station needs to hear from you next week. So let's get through this long weekend and the next week get on the stick called because Divine Mercy Radio in Kansas is going to air their fall carathon next Tuesday through Friday. So if you're listening to us in Great Bend, Kansas, or Hayes, or Colby, or Lindsborg, or anywhere, be sure to remember to support your EWTN Catholic radio station. All right, let's get back to the phones now and talk with Chris in Lubbock, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today, sir?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about the two groups, scribes and Pharisees. Sometimes Jesus will be teaching, and then people will comment, he teaches with authority, not the same authority as the scribes. But they don't include the Pharisees in that sentence. So I was wondering if you could talk about the differences between the two groups and why one would be mentioned versus the other in a context like that.
Yeah, sure. So I have to confess that I'm not an expert in this topic, but I can do my best. So the Pharisees were an ideological party within Second Temple Judaism, not just an office, right? Whereas, you know, to be a scribe is to have a particular kind of vocation of textual analysis and expertise, not necessarily to belong to an ideological party as such. And so that would be the distinction as I understand it. As to why one would be mentioned in one context versus another, honestly, I don't know. I would look at the commentaries, and I'd be interested to see, you know, are there situations, say, for example, where Mark uses one term, and Luke and Matthew, when they're quoting the Markan material, change the language, you know, and that might indicate something about whether Matthew and Luke had a particular theological agenda to amend Mark's terminology. That kind of thing is interesting and useful from a hierarchical point of view.
Uh-huh.
Whether you could make any historical meat out of it, I don't know, you know. But that's the distinction.
Okay.
And Christ seems to have spent more of his time hanging out with Pharisee types than he did with Sadducee types and other Jewish groups, which makes sense. Because he was sort of preaching to the same audience, as it were.
Yeah.
He was preaching to, you know, to lay people in rural Galilee. They would have been remote from the temple. And that was really the bread and butter of the Pharisees. You know, they weren't, the political party in power, and they were trying to offer an interpretation of the law that they thought would be livable and spiritually relevant for common people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much the same sort of target audience that Christ had in mind.
Yeah. Chris, thanks so much for your call from Lubbock. Let's go now to Lawton, Oklahoma. Here is David listening to us on the Great Oklahoma Catholic Broadcasting. Hey, David, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call as well. I am a non-Catholic who... my radio lands on EWTN a lot, and I'm learning a lot, and I appreciate the sincerity of EWTN, and it just makes my day as a non-Catholic. But my question is, when you do the Eucharist, we call it communion, some traditions call it Lord's Supper, you guys, Catholics, do it's called transubstantiation, where everybody else, like in my tradition of faith, we do subsubstantiation. Can you talk a little bit about whether mine counts or not?
Yeah, just out of curiosity, what is your tradition?
Christian Church Disciples of Christ.
Okay, thanks. So I don't know, I'd have to get you to define your terms and precisely what the Disciples of Christ believe about the nature of Christ's presence in the Eucharist, but let me get to a more fundamental question. There are multiple differences between the Catholic understanding of the Eucharist and many other Protestant traditions. And the one that was most pertinent in the 16th century, the distinction that really made the difference, was not the issue of the presence of Christ in the Eucharist. That was not the big issue. The big issue was whether or not the Eucharist is a sacrifice. And as you know, Luther believed very strongly in the doctrine of the real presence. He believed that Jesus really was there, body, blood, soul, and divinity in the Holy Eucharist. But he adamantly denied that the Eucharistic rite was a sacrificial rite and that the ministers of the Eucharist were thereby priests. And he said, no, everybody's a priest, the doctrine of the universal priesthood. And the Eucharist, you know, is the pledge of God's, you know, love and affirmation and togetherness with us, but it's not something that we do for God. It's something that God does for us. We're not offering it to Him to propitiate Him or to merit anything. That'd be a human work, and Christ took away works, and we just have faith and grace, and so it's not a sacrifice, and there's no ordained priesthood as such. And that was the big, big distinction. And then within Protestantism, there were different points of view about the doctrine of the real presence. So Luther believed in the real presence. Zwingli did not. Calvin kind of split the difference between them. And Luther's objection to the Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation was not because he objected to the presence as such, but he really objected to the use of these philosophical categories drawn from Aristotle that he thought were not traditional and not biblical. So he was more content with, you know, he's there, but you know, it's a little bit more mysterious how. And also, you know, the I think many Protestants had a problem with the idea that the accidents of bread and wine remain. And it would seem that, you know, is God engaged in a kind of deceit? You know, the Catholic doctrine says that there's no bread and wine there anymore. And the Protestant position is kind of like, well, yeah, there is. Look at it. You know, look at it, smell it, taste it. That's bread and wine. So you may have real presence, but you have to account for it in some way other than transubstantiation. Because here's the Catholic point of view. The Catholic point of view is that the substance of bread and wine is transformed into the substance of Christ's body and blood, so that while it looks like bread and wine, it is not, metaphysically speaking, ontologically speaking, it's not bread and wine. It is the substance of Christ's body and blood. That's what it is, okay? Now, if a person doesn't hold that, does their communion count? It's a different question. So remember my talking about the sacrificial rite and the priesthood and ordination. That's really the key issue. That's really the key issue for a Catholic. Because in order to have the Eucharist, which is a sacrifice in Catholic theology, you have to have a properly ordained priest who was ordained by a bishop who has apostolic succession going back to the apostles. And so whatever an individual actually believes about the Eucharist, the most fundamental reality is, was the Eucharist confected? Was it celebrated by a validly ordained priest? So even if you believed in transubstantiation, if your church lacks a validly ordained priesthood with apostolic succession, then regardless of what you believe, the Catholic position is you would not actually enjoy the real presence of Christ. Okay? By contrast, let's take a Catholic who is misinformed about the Eucharist. Maybe he's been inaccurately taught, or maybe he's a heretic. Maybe he just rejects the doctrine. So this particular Catholic does not actually believe in transubstantiation. Yet when he goes to Mass, transubstantiation happens in virtue of the priest's ordination, whether or not that Catholic believes it, right? Because it's an ontological reality. You remember Dr. Bunsen Honeydew from The Muppet Show,
right? Yeah.
Invented the gorilla detector.
Uh-huh.
And there's a wonderful scene in The Muppet Show where, you know, there is a gorilla beating the snot out of him, and the gorilla detector is not going off. And he says, if this were a real gorilla, you know, my machine would be going off. But as it's not, then appearances aside, this is not actually a gorilla, right? Of course, the thing goes off at the end after he's been pulverized.
Of course.
But like, you know, Bunsen Honeydew's conviction that it was not a gorilla did not make the gorilla absent. It was still beating the stew out of him.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so it's the belief is important, right? But it's not the individual's belief in the real presence that causes the real presence, right?
Okay.
It's the ordination and the proper execution of the rite. Now, you know, my understanding of your tradition, at least from a Catholic point of view, is that your ministry does not enjoy the sacrament of ordination validly by having hands laid upon them by validly ordained bishops that stand in apostolic succession to the apostles. And so for that reason, no, we would not regard your Eucharist as valid. Does that mean it's useless to you? And the Catholic would not say that. But the Catholic would not say it's useless. Like most Protestants believe, in my judgment, that if nothing else, the Eucharist is at least a reminder of God's benevolence towards us and of what Christ accomplished for us on Calvary. And for many Protestants, the main point of their rite of communion is to call those facts to mind and internalize them and to live by them. And a Catholic would say, yeah, you can do that. Sure. Why not? You know, that, I mean, that's not a fruitless exercise. It's just not what Catholics mean by the Eucharist.
David, is that helpful for you, sir?
Yes. Thank you so much. That's such great information, and I so appreciate you taking your time.
We appreciate you.
Me ask.
Thank you for being here.
Call back another time, David. Love to talk with you. It's Called to Communion here on EWTN. Quick reminder that coming up on many of these EWTN stations next, it's going to be Open Line Tuesday with Father Wade Menezes. That'll be at 3 p.m. Eastern, again, on most of these EWTN stations. Here is Gil now in New York listening to us there. Hello, Gil. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, hi. Enjoying the program a lot. I wanted to ask David Anders if St. Augustine held to most of the 5 points of Calvinism. That would be the question one. And then there's total depravity. Is that one of the ones that the Catholic Church agrees with, the 5 points?
Yeah, I can
go
through those. Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Gil. So the so-called 5 points of Calvinism are easy to remember because they come with a handy-dandy acronym, TULIP, right? And that's even easier because the 5 points were articulated at the Synod of Dort, which, of course, is in Holland. And if you remember the great tulip bulb craze from Holland, and when was that, the 18th century?
Yeah.
So, you know, those Dutch folks and their tulips, you know?
Yep.
And TULIP stands for total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and perseverance of the saints. All right, let's define our terms within Calvinism. Total depravity means that everything that you do, this is a Calvinist doctrine, everything that you do is intrinsically hateful to God. So when Mother Teresa pulls a dying beggar off the streets of Calcutta and nurses him, then God hates that action and desires to punish Mother Teresa with eternal unending torment because she did that good thing, but in a way that was vitiated by her own pride and concupiscence. So that literally the most righteous deed you do appears to God is a hateful abomination because your motives are not pure.
Wow.
All right, it's a very strong doctrine of sin. No, that is not Augustine's belief, nor is it the belief of the Catholic Church. Unconditional election is the idea that God elects certain individuals for salvation without respect to their foreseen merits. That is an Augustinian doctrine, and it is a Catholic doctrine.
Okay.
The Catholic Church also believes in unconditional election. If God elects us for salvation, it is not because he foresaw the good works we would do, right? There may be some other reason, inscrutable or intelligible, but it ain't that. So
Okay. That's
the one place where Calvinists and Catholics agree.
Okay.
Limited atonement. This is the Calvinist doctrine that Jesus' death is a penal substitution. That is to say that the purpose of Christ dying on the cross was to bear the punishment, the wrath of God due to sin, so that it could be diverted to him and away from us, and that he only bears the sin of the elect, not of the whole world. That is not a Catholic doctrine, and it was not Augustine's doctrine. Augustine does not seem to have believed in penal substitution, and he certainly didn't believe that it was limited in that respect. Now, there were some Augustinians in subsequent Catholic history who veered that way. In particular, Jansenism in 18th century France veered towards the doctrine of limited atonement, but not Augustine himself. All right. And although there may be some things in Augustine that could ambiguously have been read that way, which encouraged the Jansenists in their error. Irresistible grace. That is the Reformed doctrine that if God determines to extend grace to you, there ain't nothing you can do about it, bud. You're going to get that grace. And that is not a Catholic doctrine. And in my reading of Augustine, I haven't found any evidence that Augustine believed in irresistible grace.
Okay.
And then finally, the ethical position is that grace can, in fact, be resisted, right? And then finally, perseverance of the saints. Augustine does have a doctrine of perseverance of the saints, but it's not the Calvinist doctrine. The Calvinist position is that if you have grace, you will necessarily persevere. Like, you can't fall away. It's impossible for you to fall away. And that gets sort of corrupted into the Baptist idea of once saved, always saved. The Catholic position is that grace can be resisted. When Augustine talks about the perseverance of the saints, what he means by that is that those whom God has chosen for salvation will persevere. That's true. All right. So, if that's not something that you can merit. You cannot merit perseverance, and that is Augustine's position. I can't recall an occasion when Augustine specifically contemplates. He doesn't believe in the Reform version. That's clear. He never says that if you have grace, don't worry about it because you're saved. You can't possibly lose. Augustine believes that holiness of life is an ongoing moral obligation, and that failure to comply will cost you your soul. Right? He doesn't believe in the Reform version. Now, I will add that a lot of these are fine theological distinctions. That aren't always fully explicit in Augustine, one way or the other, because he's not dealing with 16th century Reform scholastics. He's in a different polemical context. He's writing against Pelagians and Manichaeans, and others. And so some of these questions get formulated in late medieval scholasticism and early Protestant scholasticism with a specificity that's lacking in Augustine. Of course, everybody claims to be the heir of Augustine. I mean, that's the one thing that Protestants and Catholics have in common, is they all claim to be authentic interpreters of Augustine. And they try to make arguments out of his texts. I think the Catholics have the better side of it, to be honest with you. It's why I became a Catholic. But there you go.
Gil, thanks so much for your call from New York. It's called Communion here on EWTN. Glad you're with us today. Here now is Samantha in Illinois, listening on the great WSFI. Hey, Samantha, what's on your mind today?
Hi. So our priest is out on medical leave, so we've had a series of visiting priests come into our parish.
Mm-hmm.
And this last Sunday at Mass, he pointed out a few difficulties, and he did it very charitably. He didn't do it publicly. I was lecturing, so he just mentioned it to me and a few other people. The first one was that as a lector, we usually process in with the priest and the altar servers with the gospel, and he said, no, only a deacon should do that. And the second one was that we've been using just regular, ordinary wine out of a box from the store. And he's like, that's not correct. So the priest that's gone, he's like maybe mid-40s, and the priest that was visiting just got ordained. And I don't know how. So I guess my first question is, the graces received, has it been a true Mass? Those kinds of questions. And just any other thoughts you have on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. So we need to draw a distinction between licit and valid, right? Licit means the law allows it. Valid means it's the absolute, bare essential for what constitutes a real Mass that confects the Lord's presence and affects the sacrifice and brings grace and salvation and so forth. You can do things that are valid in the sense that their presence or absence is not going to invalidate the Mass and make it something other than a Mass, that are nevertheless illegal in the canon law of the Catholic Church or the rubrics of the Catholic Church. The Holy See has said, do it this way for the sake of unanimity and decorum and so forth.
Uh-huh.
But failure to comply with that precise formula doesn't invalidate. The only thing that will invalidate a Mass would be things like, okay, the priest is not validly ordained. That'd be a big one right there. If you don't have a real priest, you're not going to have a real Mass.
Right.
If the priest flubs the words of consecration, right, that'd be a deal breaker. If he doesn't say the valid words of consecration, I have been to Masses before where priests have wanted to play fast and loose with the liturgy, And even with the language of the ordinary and ad lib and add stuff and take things away and, you know, make it their own sort of idiosyncratic mass, and you're sitting there cringing on the edge of your seat wondering, you know, what the next shoe is going to drop. It's a very uncharitable thing to do, in my judgment. And then they skirt right up to the edge of the consecration, and then suddenly they switch to the church's voice. Get the consecration right, and then go back off to La La Land again.
Oh, boy.
I mean, I've seen that happen.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's a valid mass. It's illegal as all get out. I mean, it's just violated all kinds of canonical principles, but it's still valid. All right.
Okay.
And so the kinds of things that you're bringing up do not invalidate a mass and have absolutely nothing to do with your reception of grace. You know, they're there to protect the integrity and the dignity of the thing, right?
Sure.
Now, do I have any other thoughts? Well, my eyebrows went up and I had a big aha moment when you said the priest that made these criticisms from the pulpit was young and newly ordained. And I went, I just bet you he was young and newly ordained, right? The code of canon law says that the people of God have a right and sometimes even a duty or obligation to speak their mind and to make their needs known to their ecclesiastical pastors, but to do so in a way that doesn't cause scandal, with respect, proper respect to persons and to their own status. And so, for example, it would be completely inappropriate for me as a private individual to say on the radio, if I thought a particular bishop or pope was doing something crazy, right? That would be very wrong of me to do, because that's not my job and it's not my place. I could hold that as an opinion and I might share it privately with someone, but I shouldn't get on the radio and do that. However, a cardinal would absolutely be in a position, and in fact, that is exactly who should do it. To go to the Pope and go, hey, Pope, you said this last Wednesday, maybe you want to clarify that because I didn't come out real well, members of a bishop's curia, his presbyteral council or the consultors of the bishop, they would be ideally placed to come alongside a bishop and go, hey, Bishop, you did this last week and that was kind of squirrely. Maybe you need to backtrack on that, right? Not me from the radio, right? And here, I think we're in a similar situation. In my judgment, if a visiting priest who's young and may not even be a pastor comes into a parish and thinks that the existing pastor is doing something that he shouldn't do, the proper thing to do is for him to privately go to that pastor. If that doesn't work, then he needs to go to the appropriate diocesan office. Maybe the bishop has a vicar for liturgy. If he doesn't, to a vicar for clergy or to the bishop himself, and that needs to take place in private. It's absolutely legitimate to bring those kinds of things to mind,
sure.
Right? But to do it from the pulpit risks scandalizing the faithful, as you yourself were scandalized, because you called me because you were scrupulous about whether or not the masses you'd been going to were valid, and it put you in a state of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
He should not have done that. And to my mind, it is a bigger scandal for the priest to criticize the pastor of a parish from the pulpit of that pastor's parish when he's sick.
Or even the sacristy, right. As in this case.
The sacristy.
Still.
That's a bigger problem than buying the wrong brand of wine for the communion.
Yeah. Samantha, thanks so much for your call. We've got about 1 minute left. Let's tackle this question from Simon. I'd like to know whether translations of the Masoretic text of the Old Testament are reliable, or whether the Septuagint is better. Thanks, Simon.
Depends on what you mean by reliable, right?
Ah.
So if you get a hold of a modern critical translation of the Old Testament, those translations are based on not one single manuscript, but on a compilation of manuscripts.
Uh-huh.
And they will usually highlight critical problems of transmission and where there are manuscript differences and things like that. And so if you read through the apparatus, you read through the footnotes, you'll get a clue about, which manuscript says this, which manuscript says that, blah, 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 blah. And those kinds of things are really of not concern to most people, okay? And so if by accurate you mean one that reflects the critical history of manuscript tradition, then a modern critical translation is going to give you that information, okay? If you want to talk about, like, you know, which one is more significant in terms of ecclesiastical history and ecclesiastical use, well, that'd be the Septuagint, right? I mean, St. Augustine dealt with that in the 4th century when he said, I use the Septuagint because it's the ecclesiastical version. It's the one the church uses in liturgy. This is why if you pick up, like, an Orthodox study Bible, they just translate the Septuagint. They just leave off the Hebrew altogether, right?
Yeah.
So it all kind of depends on your purposes. And as Catholics, we're allowed to use modern critical editions, and we use them even in Mass. But I say consult them all.
Simon, thanks so much for your question. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Don't forget, we do this program Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern, so that would include tomorrow at the same time for the Wednesday edition of Call to Communion. On behalf of our great team here, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. We will see you tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless.